This podcast is sponsored by PAX. Whether on water, on land, or in the air, PAX bags are both versatile and flexible backpacks that are perfectly suitable for your requirements in the most demanding of environments. PAX bags are highly regarded due to their exceptional performance in pre-hospital and in critical care environments. Renowned for their durability, they endure harsh conditions while providing rapid and reliable access to essential kit. So their well-organized compartments and customizable configurations enhance efficiency in high-stress situations. PAX bags are designed with infection control in mind and are easy to clean and disinfect. The highly visible colors and reflective strips add quick identification and adherence to quality standards, assuring reliability. The versatility of PAX bags caters to a diverse EMS providers, but also delivers vital equipment and durability and ease of use for pre-hospital critical care services globally. I've used PAX bags in a number of critical care situations and they're absolutely excellent. Please see the show notes for further details.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast. In this conversation, we're going to be looking at the relationship between paramedic theory and practice with Vince Clark. So what to do in the conversation is look at Vince's doctorate in education on this very subject, some of the various frameworks for acquisition of skills through simulation, reflective models of learning, the progression of novice to expert, and indeed the directive versus facilitative learning. We also wanted to look at the theory versus practice conceptual frameworks, and finally, students' views on where they perceive learning originates. So to do this, I have Vince Clark with me. Vince has been a paramedic since 1998, progressing on to an IHCD tutor. He then progressed to complete his undergraduate degree in paramedic science and then went on to complete a master's degree in health, law and ethics in practice and then a doctorate in education. So he's currently the principal lecturer at Hertfordshire University Paramedic Science Programme, a trustee for education with the College of Paramedics and indeed an external advisor to several organisations. Welcome to the podcast, Vince.
Thank you. Good morning.
Vince, I just wondered if we could just start by just digging into why this area of study sparked such interest for you.
Yeah, well, as you've said in the introduction, I've been I joined the London Ambulance Service in 1996 and then progressed to paramedic in 1998 and was responsible for looking after students in practice as a practice educator or supervisor, whatever the term we had then, and then worked as a link tutor supporting students at university, such as yourself, a long time ago, and helping develop the practical skills and the application of being a paramedic, as we saw it, alongside the university role of educating and giving the students an understanding of the theoretical principles. And at the time that we started doing that and degrees for paramedics first came out, they were appeared to be quite separate things. And that's from my perspective, to do with the evolution of the educational pathway, in that those paramedic degrees were generally situated in nursing schools, they had nursing staff, and the paramedics were just sort of brought in to do the practical paramedic-y things. So there was a difference between the learning that students were undertaking in the classroom, often in those early days taught by nurses and nursing and other healthcare colleagues, and then the paramedic stuff that we would come in and do. And that's where it sort of started, is the students' perceptions of those differences. And when they would come over in the situation that we had, they'd come to myself and my colleagues who worked for the ambulance service and delivered ambulance service style training for the paramedic students. The students appeared to see that quite differently to going to a lecture and learning about research methodology or biosciences or other aspects of their paramedic practice. So that's where it first started, and sort of my thinking along the lines of, well, is why do the students see it as two separate things? Is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? How can we better integrate those two sides of education to make the student more well-rounded and, at the end of the day, a better lifelong learning paramedic?
I fundamentally agree with that, Vince. I think, like you said, making them or giving them all the tools to be more prepared for the workplace, but the applicability of knowledge translation into practice so that they they can see commonality between studies and indeed what they're seeing in the real life world is makes absolute sense to me. And as you said, you know, any course really has is an iterative process. And the origins, very much when I was at university in the early 2000s, it was heavily nursing, and you could see why it comes from that background. But then differentiating it out to make sure we are narrowing the gap to real life practice and indeed applicability to practice. And it seems to be that was the central theme of your doctorate thesis. Just you know, could you maybe speak to your doctoral thesis and indeed how you conducted your research?
Yeah, so it was a again trying to get the perceptions of the students to find out what they experienced and what they felt about the concepts of theory and practice, and also to speak to practice educators who were at that time hadn't the majority of them hadn't gone through a higher education program, and they were IHCD paramedics on the whole. Pretty much at that time, and their views of the degree process, and which at the time a lot of in those early days were, well, you don't need a degree to be a paramedic, was a phrase that was often thrown about, and it's a practical job. You don't need to do all of that learning. Was coming from generally the people who hadn't done that learning and didn't have that depth of understanding. So I wanted to get the perspective of the students who were embedded in the learning process, and the practice educators who saw the application of that theoretical knowledge in the practice setting during practice placements. So I did a series of questionnaires to both students, undergraduate students, and practice educators, and then followed that up with a series of focus groups and interviews to dig a little bit deeper into working out the perceptions of those individuals and trying to get behind the initial reaction of both the students and the practice educators. Well, you don't need to know that, and why would they be saying that? Why would a practice educator be saying that to a student? And trying to unpick that and go deeper into the concepts behind the thinking.
So let's just look at a few models and indeed frameworks that you approached within your thesis, actually. And one of the, I suppose, more common themes and/or experiences of a student is fidelity, high fidelity or low fidelity simulation, and that translation from the information on a screen, didactic, to simulation, which is an analog of reality. So that, your thesis, you look at Eleanor's 2007 work on frameworks for acquisition of experience and skills through simulation. Could you maybe speak to how sort of simulation adds to our experience, and indeed how the iterative process of simulation?
Yeah, and I think from my perspective, the concepts of theory and practice are one thing to explore, but they're concepts. And then when you try and put that into a working model, there's still the so what. And that's something that I often ask whenever I'm researching or writing or doing something, is, well, so what? What's the point? What's the impact? And simulation is one of those areas where you're considering all of the theoretical aspects. You're trying to put them into practice, although it's arguably not real life, as in they're not live patients with live presentations. So it's trying to work out what you want to achieve from that simulation, and using that, from my perspective, as a development from a purely classroom theoretical concept into the application of those theories in a safe, controlled environment at varying different levels. So that the student can then go into practice and be supported in the dynamic changing environment that they experience out dealing with actual patients. So the challenge with simulation is how complex to make it. Should it be complex? Should it be simple? And what do those differing levels of complexity do for the student participant from a learning perspective? So Alan Ayres' work sort of went towards the suspension of disbelief and trying to see at what point do the participants of that simulation fully engage and recognize that actually this is a learning opportunity and I'm embedded and fully committed and going to go through it. And the differing levels, so you're starting off with discrete skills and learning, so paper-based exercises which don't have much psychomotor practical application. And then going up the levels to the way you'd have a simulated patient, which would be a real live person who can answer your questions, who the student can assess, can physically touch, can engage with. And that's where you get a certain level of fidelity. But the limitations of that are that that patient can't have an actual illness, generally in simulation. If you were doing hospital rounds, you could work with medics to actually see patients with the medical presentation. But in simulation, they can't. They can't present with traumatic injuries. They can't simulate a tension pneumothorax, for example. So you get to that mid-level of simulation, which is with a live person and gives the student the opportunity to engage and interact and work on the social level of how they might practice. But the higher the fidelity, the more reliant you are on mannequins and other simulation equipment. So you get to a point on that scale where you've got good engagement, good fidelity of an actual person responding. But to go to the next level of high fidelity, you reintroduce mannequins, which then reduces the fidelity in a number of aspects. So simulation plays a very important role in cementing the concepts of theory and the practical application. And from my perspective, it also gives you a very good opportunity to control the environment, control the situation, and allow the learner to engage and see how they cope with that situation in that safe setting.
So let's look at another tenet of learning, and that's maybe the post-simulation reflective practice. And reflective practice happens on many levels. I think, in situ, it happens in the debrief because you can start to, in real time, unpick the simulation and the performance in simulation, which is helpful, and that's a form of reflective practice. But in the thesis, you denote a number of models, really, so the palpate model and the I-fear model, as important, almost seminal work to acknowledge reflection and the importance of reflection. Could you speak to reflection in your thesis and what you sort of derived from it?
Yeah, and I think this is one of those things that some individuals reflect, and they do it as a matter of course. They'll think about an incident that they've attended or an experience that they've had. They'll think about it and they'll ask themselves, so what? Why am I thinking about it, first of all? And this is where you get into the realms of metacognition and thinking about thinking. And this is what people often find difficult. It comes quite naturally to some, more challenging to others. And that's where trying to think about how you felt about an incident when you were in it, unpicking that to then discover why you had those thoughts and feelings and whether they were they could have been improved or enhanced or developed for future learning, accompanied with finding out what happened to the individual, the patient you were treating or the situation that you were managing, and whether that could have been impacted on differently had you acted or behaved differently yourself. So there's lots of thinking to be done. Some people, as I say, would do that naturally and just think about, oh, I could have done that better, I could have done that differently, and they'll just log it and that's it, job done, move on, they've reflected. Others need a process, and sometimes a directive process is really helpful to give you the questions to ask yourself. And some of the models that I allude to and discuss. So yeah, Baxter has a palpate model. The palpate model is predominantly about identifying if there's a theory practice gap, and there are fundamental challenges in that because if you don't know the underlying theory of a presentation or a circumstance or how you're going to manage it, it's really difficult to identify that you don't know those things if you don't know that you don't know them. So it's that unconscious incompetence coming in there. Whereas you've got the models such as I-fear, where you're looking at the incident, thinking about your feelings, evaluating the care, analysing, and then looking at your response to the situation and how you can then take that forward and develop further. But one of my preferred models for paramedics was Turner. Now I do have a image of it to remind me. Turner's, yeah. So Turner's model asks a series of questions, and again, with all of these models, this comes back to the concepts of theory and practice. In theory, on paper, these models read well and they work, but then you've got to actually facilitate it and apply it in practice and do it for yourself. So it's asking the right questions and following the lines. So with Turner, the questions start on the outside of the box. So for example, what did you do? And then why did you do this? And actually asking yourself those questions is sometimes quite challenging. I've been doing some simulation this week with some third-year students, and as you mentioned, you do a debrief at the end of the simulation to unpick it so that they can better learn from their experience. And sometimes they can't recall what they've just done. And that's where trying to get an individual to recall what they've done and the steps that they took to get to the next stage of the process that they're undertaking. Sometimes they don't know because they're either on autopilot, distracted by the scene, other things going on. So even something as simple as a question that is a starting point, what did you do? Actually, that can take quite a lot of thinking. And I'm thinking, what did I actually do? How did I actually approach it? Who did I speak to first? What did I say to them? What was their reaction? And that level of thinking to try and recall what went on is quite key in then developing and going on to the next steps. And so, well, why did you do that? So it's that level of insight and reflection as to, first of all, establishing what exactly happened. Then you look at the in Turner's model, how did you feel about the call? So the incident that you attended, and why did you feel that way? And this is something that when we first started doing reflection as a paramedic profession, we adopted a nursing model from Gibbs, and that was a lot of feelings focused. And my experience of that was that the paramedics were less engaged with the feelings side and were more engaged with the practicalities of the situation, which is why I like to suggest that individuals look at all sorts of reflective models and find the one that works for them and follow it in a way that works for them. And if feelings aren't your thing, don't dwell on that. Go to the practicalities. So in Turner's model, the next practicalities are what were the ideal treatments for that patient? And how could you seek to adapt those treatments in the future to make sure that the patient gets the best possible care? So, yes, yeah, so my relationship with reflection is that it's something that needs to be done. How you do it, there's lots of different models and options, but formalizing your approach does help you through the process.
Vince, can we look at the journey between novice to expert and what that looks like? But also, interestingly, I think what I got from your thesis as well is how that's perceived from a student perspective as well, because I think maybe empirically the path from novice to expert is quite different to the perception from a student from novice to expert. Could you sort of speak to that?
Yeah, I think, and novice to expert, it's from Benner, from nursing, the concept and that terminology. And it's really difficult to define what makes an expert paramedic. And I think that this is where there's challenges. Because of the nature of our work, predominantly on ambulances, although that is, as we'll know, diversifying considerably. But predominantly, the majority of paramedics will start out on ambulances. The majority of them will be out as the senior clinician from day one, pretty much, maybe with some preceptorship in place, maybe with some ongoing support. But they're out there on their own, being an autonomous healthcare professional. So the challenges with developing from a novice, which they will be on day one, to becoming expert in that role, are very much in the hands of the individual. And that's where the consideration of your actions and the associated outcomes is vitally important, because if you don't consider those things, if you don't reflect on your practice, see what went well, how you can enhance your practice, what you might have done wrong, and how you can learn from that, if you don't do those things, you're never going to move beyond the novice element and start to progress up into expertise. So it's very much a self-led thing. And getting up to those stages does require a high degree of insight and a high degree of, again, metacognition, thinking about how you think and how you approach incidents. And we used to talk about paramedics with 20 years experience, and they've been doing the same year for 20 years. They might have been out on the road for 20 years, but they haven't developed at all. And the converse to that would be a learner or a paramedic who's now a qualified registrant. They're out there, they're learning on every incident, they're reflecting on every incident, they're developing on every incident. The trajectory, the learning trajectory of that individual is going to be much steeper, and they're going to get to expertise much sooner, and it's not necessarily a time-related trajectory. And that's something that individuals can absolutely impact on.
It's really interesting you say that actually, Vince, because like you said, it's what became apparent to me in my years of the career was it was about the rooms you put yourself in and the people you exposed yourself to and the variety of people. So for instance, I learned a lot from emergency medicine, a lot from M&M, D&D, so death and disability, brief dissecting incidents with ED consultants, subject matter experts, getting to learn how they think. And again, that's not time-based, that's exposure-based to all these different disciplines. And I think what that does as well is the Dunning-Kruger effect, where there's this spike of overconfidence, and with you don't really know much, but you think you know everything, and then you get to the peak of the bell where you actually quite unsure whether you know anything, and then the downward slope where the more senior you get, the more you realize actually what you don't know, and actually that exposure to different professionals and indeed different specialisms, and also the feedback and outcome data from that, which again isn't time bound, it's exposure bound to various communities, just actually illustrates that profound, it brings you on that learning curve. It illustrates, and again, I was being asked some very difficult questions in my early years in London HEMS, and also in various other roles as well. And again, that put me on the back foot, allowed me to learn more, allowed me to go back and research things, and actually made me far more well-rounded, but also expose these massive gaps in my own practice. And again, it's not a time-bound thing. And that revelation alone, putting yourself in uncomfortable situations, putting yourself in rooms with different subject experts is fundamental, really. And I think you're right, the succinct shift we see, and again, just maybe to deviate from the questions for a second, do you see the progression now of students who are now registrants migrating through either indeed to experts or indeed pivoting away from maybe an ambulance-based position quite a lot more rapidly, and or do you see that transition occurring more frequently from what it used to?
Lots of things to consider there. I think one of the so going back to the learning of students, one of the focuses that we have now, rather than how many hours you do in practice, which was never really worked from a quality of paramedics perspective, it's now about the having good learning, good support, so that a practice educator can facilitate that reflection and you get that learning trajectory. Now, juxtaposed to that is the culture that exists within ambulance services, which sometimes isn't as conducive to learning and progression as it could be. And I think that's where the individuals who want to progress and want to learn and want to reflect and develop sometimes are inhibited from doing so because of the environment that they work in and the way in which that environment is set up and the culture within it. It's sometimes isn't very supportive of people that want to move on. So it comes back to that individual needing to have the drive and the desire to move on. That then sometimes, from my experience, gets challenging when opportunities arise for individuals to go into other settings where the expectation of those settings is that they're getting a well-rounded, experienced, competent, thoughtful paramedic who can act as an expert, for example, going into primary care. But what they actually get is somebody who hasn't necessarily got to that point of development. They haven't had that metacognition. They haven't asked themselves the difficult questions if nobody else has been there to ask them the difficult questions. And they have that confidence over competence challenge where they think they know what they're doing, but actually they don't. And they get put in a position where they're given patients that they can't necessarily deal with. And that causes a different type of challenge. And that's about expectations of other healthcare providers. And in the case I'm talking about, GP's practice, for example, employing paramedics without an appreciation that paramedics, like any other healthcare professional, are on a spectrum. You've got your novice and you've got your expert, and anywhere between that might be where you want to take somebody on board. But you have to get the right person to undertake that role. So again, it comes back to the individual.
It kind of leads me quite nicely onto this kind of differentiation between directive and facilitated learning within your thesis, Vince. Could you maybe speak to the difference between sort of directive and then facilitated learning?
Yeah, I think this is, again, it's a settings-based approach. So if you've got situations where you're not clear what you're trying to achieve and you just need a learner to do something, you can be very directive and tell them to undertake that task and they just follow instructions and you direct the learner to what you need them to do. That's quite limited in that it's basically giving instruction rather than enabling the learner to better understand why they're doing something and move along with the decision and the process and the application of a skill, for example. Whereas a facilitative approach means that the practice educator or the preceptor or the mentor can create a learning environment in which the student can be supported to learn and develop and apply their skills in the situation as required. And then that way, the learner is much more engaged in the process. They're facilitated to undertake the learning and the application of the discrete skill or the assessment or the decision making, rather than being told to do something and then that's a box tick, they've done it. And that would then lead to much deeper embedding of that learning and understanding so that it's more embedded and they can take it forward to future practice.
We've unpicked a little bit around Turner's model of reflection, actually, and I actually absolutely agree with you. I think it's a preferential model of reflection because it really does dig into what were the differential diagnosis, what does that constitute, and how do you make sense of best practice within that. So I guess I'd like to pivot towards maybe one of the most complex themes within your doctoral thesis, Vince, and that was just the interplay between theory and practice, conceptual curriculum areas, and then the overlap of so it's the overlap of the domains of theory and practice, and how they interact, how they overlap, and indeed how a learner progresses through theory into practice with the applicability.
Yeah, and this is quite, it was quite a complex theme. Some areas of paramedic curriculum are very obviously related to doing the role, and that tends to be your psychomotor skills. And those are the things that students tend to be more focused on and think, right, okay, airway management, putting an airway adjunct in, cannulating, giving drugs, all of those psychomotor practical skills seem to be very clearly linked to practice, and students can see why that works, why they're doing that in the university and then doing it in practice because it's very overt. Other areas are or have been in the past much less overt. Things like biosciences. Biosciences, to a degree, absolutely is relatable, but there's a lot of areas of biosciences that students cover to underpin the simplest of concepts that they can then build upon to understand the more complex concepts that are then applied in practice or considered in practice. So sometimes there's a disconnect between the introductory principles because they're not overtly practice related. Other areas that are a little more challenging, research in the past has definitely been a challenge from a theory versus practice perspective, in that in the past, students saw research as a very distant thing, not much to do with their practice. That has changed in recent years. We've got much more active research within the paramedic sphere. There's a lot of research studies going on, a lot of studies that students will be involved in when they're out in practice, and their practice educators can talk to the concepts around the studies that are being undertaken. So that's something that's actually has in recent years started to switch, and students are more appreciative that studying and understanding research principles can have much more of a direct impact on their practice because they can see it. That's and that again, that's a recent development.
Absolutely, and I very much agree with that. I have seen a lot more applicability, but also just there's been a lot more engagement and indeed paid roles actually for paramedic readers, paramedic researchers to be part of institutions, higher education institutions, ambulance services, air ambulance services. You're right that it's not only the proliferation, it's the engagement piece has very much increased in the past few years. I'm going to ask you something not necessarily controversial, but very much we spoke offline about the engagement and how of technology and the digital world. I'm going to speak soon to a fellow student of my time, Sam Willis, who's done his PhD on virtual reality and the educating paramedics through virtual reality and how the appropriateness and indeed closing the learning gap through virtual reality. Could you maybe speak to your perception and indeed thoughts on how virtual reality and indeed augmented reality narrows this sort of the theory practice gap?
Yes, yeah. I think that's another exponential change is technology, and that's had a vast impact on all areas of life, including education and paramedic practice. So the incorporating into educational pathways is absolutely a must, and appreciating that learners are quite different now to what they were even 5, 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago. We've got quite a different cohort of students coming in. They're digital natives. They are absolutely at one with technology. And that impacts on the way that they consume information, the way they understand things, the bite size approach that's now more usual than compared to 20 years ago. If you wanted an article from a journal, you'd have to go to the library, you'd have to order it, you'd have to wait for the British Library to photocopy it, send it back to you on a piece of paper, and then you realize, okay, it's not actually as much use as I thought it was going to be. And that process can take 2 or 3 weeks. Now it's all on their phone. So it's quite a different setup. And that's something that as educationalists, myself and my colleagues are very aware of. And we're very aware that we're not, some of us, myself included, aren't as technologically savvy as others, and particularly as the students. So it's definitely something that we're exploring. One project that I've been working on for a while has been a virtual environment, and it's a concept that we've had for a long time, but it's now something that we're going to have the capacity within our team to develop further, where we'll have a virtual environment with cases that students will follow throughout their time at university, and we'll have a street with images of properties and individuals that live in that property, and you can interact with that system and see who lives there, what their medical background is. And we can look at that from a case-based learning perspective, and then follow those individuals throughout the years of the program. So in the first year, you might go to an individual who is maybe, for example, having central crushing chest pain, and you deal with that. The next year, they may have developed a different problem. And in the third year, you might be going to that same patient as a palliative care case. So that's the concept behind it. So we're trying to get engaged with that type of learning. Alongside that, with the augmented or virtual reality, it absolutely has a place, and it's how it's used and how it's utilized for the most benefit. And if you and that, that's another change recently, that the number of students that we have is considerably more than it was 5, 10, 15 years ago. And there's a lot of paramedic students around the UK. So we're up to 8,000 plus student paramedics in the UK. So that's a lot of people. And it's utilizing those technologies in the most productive way for the most number of students. For example, with some of the virtual reality systems and approaches, you could have a group of students in a classroom watching the screen and watching what their colleague does in a separate room and how they interact. And you can debrief that and reflect on that live. So the cohort of 30 students in the room get the same learning and experience as the one who's actually doing it, although it's not exactly the same. And that's where the challenges come in, as to making sure that any of those technologies work for the majority from a cost effectiveness perspective. But I'm sure Sam will speak to that in greater depth.
Indeed, and like one thing I picked up and really appreciate what you just said around the continuity of not just the continuity of learning, but just something which actually maps onto reality, which is like you said, you can actually see the same bit, and this is very true from a life of a paramedic. You can see the same patient twice, three times for different ailments, different pathologies, and that maps onto reality. But the semblance of being able to grade or score your performance either with the same pathology over time, or indeed a different one, and see the maturation of your own practice, the level of your differential diagnosis, of your assessments, of your conclusions, is also a powerful learning tool to look back and see how you've learned. My next question, Vince, and we're starting to come into land, would be around. In your thesis denoted really that students perceive a large part of learning comes from books and papers. I think it was posited 36% from books and 69% from research papers. Is that congruent with your findings and indeed congruent with what you see now in practice as a principal lecturer?
And I think that goes back to the changes in technology and access to information now. And when I was looking at those areas, it was concepts and what people think of as theory, to try and get that conceptual mapping to then determine, well, is there a distinction between theory and practice, and is that a problem, or is it something that we can work with and develop models to overcome? The difference now, and this is a difference in the last 5 years or so, is that a student's phone has an awful lot of information on it, and some of that information is correct theory and it's well researched and it's documented. Other areas of that are opinion and not supported and just on random Google search hits. So we start to then get another challenge where the perception of theory and the value and the validity that's given to that theory starts to alter. And you start to get a situation where some students will think, well, yeah, I've Googled it. It says that, therefore that's the case. And you start to get competing theories which are not correct. And that adds a slightly different dynamic to the theory practice relationship, where you've got misinformation, and that might not help in the circumstances that you're trying to develop a better understanding to deal with an incident. So certainly access to theory has evolved. Perceptions of theory, I think, have also evolved and continue to evolve. And the reliance on technology and the information that's at your fingertips on the phone is sometimes not valued, as in, so the quality of that information isn't necessarily valued by the student as being good or bad.
Really interesting you say that, because I think one of the things I learned from my master's, more so even, and I think that was again just the timing of things for me, was like you say, the hierarchy of evidence, of hierarchy of research, not all research is the same, and that sort of critical analysis piece where by you can really start to dig into research. And actually my tendency was, as a student, at undergraduate, was really just to read the conclusion to a study, and again, that's not a bad thing. But actually, from a critical analysis perspective, looking far more at the methodology, far more at the type of research which was undertaken, to kind of, because they say, you know, bad information in, bad information out, and actually, because what you're taking from a conclusion is something in time, there's no differentiation of whether that's actually a robust study or not, you know, the sample size, the external validity, or, you know, on and on. And I think that critical analysis piece is super helpful in life. You know, you can pull that out of education and practice, and apply that to lots of pieces of information in life. You know, just because it says something on a tablet, or indeed in a shop, or on a podcast, has there been, is there critical analysis of that information? And that skill alone was super useful in practice.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. You can apply that to anything across the board, and definitely a great skill to have.
So, Vince, as we come into land, just a couple more questions. One would be around the future of paramedic education, and indeed where you sort of see it heading within the near term.
I think we've had a lot of challenges as a profession through COVID. And coming out of COVID, and that did impact on learning in practice, and the way that ambulance services currently work, with long delays outside hospitals, that does impact on students' learning and the number of incidents that they attend, the range of incidents that they attend. So we're having to start to think about going back to reinvigorating simulation and focusing simulation. Perhaps more so than we had done in fairly recent years, because students were picking up a lot from practice. They were getting a good variety of incidents that they're attending, a good number of incidents, and they were getting good developmental experiences. The change now in practice is that the number of incidents that they might attend on a shift is fewer because of the turnaround times. They tend to be fairly low acuity. No, the low acuity incidents where there might be a lot of history taking and patient assessment to be undertaken, but there's not often much more to be found. So there's a hugely variant experience from students. So some students will go out on a 4-week placement and not see any patient that's actually unwell in the big sick sense. Others will go out and on their first shift, they'll have half a dozen incidents. So there's that disparity. So I think going back to how we address that disparity would be to use simulation more than we have done in recent years to balance with that practice experience. I think the other thing is having a mind to where paramedics might end up, but not focusing on that at the undergraduate level, because as we discussed, you might be a newly qualified paramedic just registered. That doesn't mean that you have the skills and requisite attributes to go into another setting that an advanced, more experienced paramedic might be working in. So we have to be mindful of the profession is absolutely flying ahead, going all over the place. To some degrees, it's a victim of its own success. We're a very desirable commodity within healthcare, so there's opportunities there. But are they opportunities that should be available to novices at the point of graduation, and should we be preparing paramedics for those roles at the point of graduation, or should we be giving them the lifelong learning skills that mean that they can leave their undergraduate degree and continue on that learning trajectory so that at a point in their career they can diversify and go into one of those areas? So there's lots of considerations now based on the changing landscape within the paramedic profession.
Indeed, and as you said, the paramedic is almost like the Swiss Army knife of healthcare, because the adaptability into a nursing role, or or indeed a GP role, or indeed lots of custody roles and others is proliferated over the last few years. My last question, as we come into land, and this is around the application of your thesis into practice, because Hertford University were certainly fundamental in paving the way for undergraduate paramedic science education in the initial stages back 20 odd years ago. Could you speak to how some of the concepts from the thesis have been instituted at Hertford University, sort of to narrow this theory practice gap? You spoke to simulation, and I absolutely agree with you. Is there anything else you're either teaching or advocating?
We've got a lot of things, and this is the benefit of being the program lead and heavily involved in the College of Paramedics and curriculum development and everything else, means that I've got a good oversight of where we're going and what we can do. And one of the so the several things that I can embed into the program to really try and keep up with everything. One of the main things, and it's relatively simple, is focusing on case-based learning. And when we're talking about a particular presentation, situation, treatment, whatever it might be, if we focus on a case, particularly a case that one of the lecturing team has been involved in, the immediate response of the students is that they're more engaged, because it's something that we've actually been to and seen and dealt with, and they can more directly see the applicability of the theoretical concepts into that case as it presented in practice. So a heavy focus on case-based learning, and that's across all modules, whether it's anatomy and physiology, social sciences, law and ethics, everything considering the applicability rather than just looking at abstract concepts. So very heavy on case-based learning. We have a spiral curriculum, so we develop on the same themes from the first year to the third year, and that's based on the four pillars of practice. So we've got our leadership and management pillar, patient assessment is where it comes under clinical for us, research and education. So we have those embedded throughout the program so that the students can appreciate that that's where they're going to go in their lifelong learning pathway, one of those areas or a combination of them. And we now focus out on trying to talk to students about learning, so learning about learning, and really kicking off with concepts of learning, how they're going to learn at university, the principles of theoretical understanding and knowledge acquisition, and the application of that in practice, and how to be a learner in a practice setting, which, if unless you think about it, it doesn't just happen. And I think that's the assumption that we've had in the past is, and some institutions haven't quite caught up with this yet. It's like, yeah, we'll just stick a student out in practice, stick them in a hospital or an ambulance, and they'll learn stuff. They might not. It needs to be structured. It needs to be supported. There need to be clear learning outcomes for the placement and for the placement provider, so everybody knows what the point is, and it needs needs good, robust support mechanisms. And that's another thing that we have with our link tutors, who look after the links between us and the ambulance service and support the practice educators to support the students. So there's a lot of things that my research has fed into to directly enhance the program that we deliver.
Vince, thank you for the last hour. It's been hugely insightful from my perspective. I think what we'll do is we'll link into the show notes the thesis itself. It is fantastic reading. I would definitely say take a little bit of time to dissect it and digest it, because it was a fascinating read for myself. So we'll certainly do it. But thank you for your time, Vince.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.